Thank you. That was an excellent Dharma talk. I appreciate your politeness. Yes. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Yeah. The three refugees. Yes, the Pali translations are available from Wisdom Publications in good translations. The longer length, the middle length, numbered sayings now are available. And the connected sayings. These are substantial collections of the most of the essential teachings of the historical Buddha, as far as we know, translated from the Pali by a few people, but Bhikkhu Bodhi is the most well represented in that collection. And Wisdom Publications is online, and you can get the digital version or the paper version, and it'll sustain you the rest of your life. It's something I still, you know, am reading and diving into, and it, as my practice goes, the more I appreciate it, you know. Also go onto our website, Birkin Monastery website, and we have a reading list which goes from beginner to intermediate to advanced, and it'll give you some directions on what to read and so forth. And we also have recorded talks, like us, you know, kind of talks like I've done this weekend, not just by me, but by other monks and nuns. And we've collected them in a huge collection, 4,500 talks. I don't know, I'll keep you for a while. And you can it's all free, and you can look up by subject or by monk or by nun, topic or personality, and it covers a huge range of Dhamma talks, and it's good. You can use them, you know, when you're driving or when the voice of another is a very helpful thing. It can pull you out of a mood. You know, you're trapped in your own mood, and to have an external voice talk to you in a different, that is in a different energy and a different vision, it can help, you know, pull you right out of that space into a different space. Yes. Yeah, you have to get more detached from the process, but you do have to keep the process up. We dismiss it without malice, you know. It's kind of like getting mice out of your house, not with a trap or anything, but, you know, a lot of people, they have a lot of aversion to insects, and, you know, if you got an insect in your house, you feel like somehow they're on your territory, or they're... There's no need to get all angry at them. You just catch them carefully in this little thing and take them outside. That's all. Let them go. They're just little... We call them pests, don't we? So they pester you. So, but we don't... We're not angry at them. We just don't want them in our house. That's all. And we take them outside. So these things are just... universal irritants, and we just want to take them outside and let them free, you know, set them. So that's, we want to carefully do that. And each time we do, it's not only a matter, not matter of being angry at them, it's a matter of actually rejoicing. And we just succeeded again to interrupt and free ourselves from these things. So each time, it's not a failure, it's actually a success. So, I mean, if we can do it by, the first tactic is dismissal, just mere dismissal. We don't want to spend, we want to spend the least amount of time on this as possible. We don't get into a long analysis of the thing, of the anger, or the, we just want to say, if we can, we can just say, go away. As soon as you detect it, just go away. And then if not, if it's persistent, then we go to replacement. And replacement is that we try to fill the space optimally. And say if it was, if we're, you know, brooding on anger, then we have to go to somebody or some situation that we always feel warmth and goodwill and love. And we have to remember that and imagine that and go embrace them and be uplifted by that and fill yourself with that. So there's no room for the other thing. The space is full. They're mutually exclusive. There is no space for that. So we're, these are techniques the Buddha gives specifically for removing these distracting thoughts. They call it removal of distracting thoughts. And he has these systematic ways of doing this. Sometimes it will be persistent and it will require a gradual process, four stages. Running. So a man is running. He thinks, why am I running? Why don't I walk? And he walks. He says, why am I walking? Why don't I sit down? And he sits down. Why am I sitting down? Why don't I lie down? And he lies down. So not sometimes the energy of these things is quite strong. We can't just go from running to lying down. So we have to bring it down in stages. I mean, it's not specifically that you should go running and then walk and then, but you might decide that, well, the first thing I need to do is just change my posture, maybe take a few deep breaths, and maybe I need to read a book for a while or hear a Dhamma talk or go talk to my friend or make some food or something like that. I'm just interrupting and winding this, the momentum of this down. And then after you've read the book, you know, it's still a little lingering with you, you still feel that. And then so now it's time to just do some breath meditation for a while. And then you feel it subsiding more. And you're moving towards eventually this dissolving on you, just departing. This kind of thing, especially with anxiety, like anxiety is not, it's just a kind of a, you can't locate it. It's just a whole, your whole sort of, from your neck down is kind of this feeling, a slightly nauseating. And it's not really connected to specific thoughts either. So that we have to undo that by pure serenity, just focusing on the breath. Winding down. But sometimes, as I think I mentioned in early in the retreat, that before I knew about meditation, I used to have to go for walks. And it would take me 2 hours to kind of wind down the anxiety. So now it's a mental process. Anxiety is a mental process. If we can do any, you know, you can just try to start making pies. It's a good beginning. But really get into it. things like that. Yes?
I was wondering about working with regret or past actions.
Yeah, the Buddha's, you know, you really have to have some faith in the Buddha. He says, just don't think about it. It's over. No remorse. Because quite often we're convinced that a good person should have remorse. We should feel bad about that. And we have to do our time. We have to do our penance. It's not okay to just drop that. I need to suffer. I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to suffer. And the Buddha says, No. It's very nice of you to offer to suffer, but I really think you know, there's enough suffering in the world. I think we should get on with the happy part, you know. It's over, it's done, and it's time to just stop that. And, of course, be careful in the future. Don't do that again, because remorse, you know how remorse is. It's hard to get rid of, but the Buddha says, do not think that it's a good thing to have. It's not a good thing to have. Guilt and remorse. But, of course, this is to regards to the past. Regarding the present and the future, you should have a judicious sense of care for your own happiness. Like, you don't do things that you will regret later. You're afraid to. You don't like that. You should have a wholesome sense of fear for your own well-being. Don't go close to the edge of cliffs and so forth. It's not worth it to look over because you're risking your life. You know, just stay back a few feet. Be careful with your life. But as the past, you have to say, whatever. I don't feel like I should get off the hook for free. But the Buddha says the door is open. Walk out. Yeah. It's a strange attitude, isn't it? But the Buddhist geniuses think like that, you know. Stop. Yeah. Yes, at the back there. Well, even the Buddha had to have standards and clear types of behavioral limits about what you can and can't do. If you want to be part of that group, you know, if you have people working in that environment, there's boundaries, there's levels, and if they don't conform to that, then they shouldn't be there, right? It's not judgment. It's not ill will. And that's what you have to do, is make sure that you personally are not having ill will. But it is a matter of, here's the standards, and we have a job that needs to be done. And if you can do it, you're in. And if you can't do it, you'll have to find other work that you can do. And that's the truth. That's just the truth. It's not... There's no judgment in it. It's just that here's the facts of the case. You have to state this is what the situation is. And then, you know, you have to carry out this with competence and realize that, you know, it's all out in the open what is expected, and if you can't do it, that's fine. You have to do something else. There's nothing intrinsically harmful about that. There's no ill will to that. It's just making the work. You know, if we didn't work that way, it could be very chaotic. If we didn't have these kind of things, it just wouldn't work. So it's not, there's no level of ill will there. So one should do, you know, in business, be competent. Just be competent. Yeah. Yes?
I just have a question about meat eating.
Yes.
Is it a good thing or not a good thing?
Well, meat eating, what you put in your mouth is really neutral. There's no moral dimension to what you put in your mouth. What comes out of your mouth, though, that's the important part. So you watch what you say. Watch what you say. And, you know, this meat eating is just part of human structure. It happens. We don't. We certainly want to intentionally kill any beings. So that is personal. You don't. You want to abstain from that killing. But the complexity and number of factors involved in the production of meat and all this kind of stuff in the world is quite beyond an individual's capacity to take responsibility for. And so these are final products of a whole series, a whole chain of actions and things. And one of the things the Buddha says, you know, if we ever hope to get out of samsara, we cannot, we need to be clear about one thing. You're responsible for your own intentional actions, but nobody else's. You know, it's what you do intentionally. And that is something, if it involves hostility and injury, intentional hostility and injury, then it's a negative thing. Eating a piece of chicken is not, no, there's no hostility, nor is there any injury. It's meat, it's dead. The person who kills the thing is doing something unskillful. And that's they're doing something unskillful. That one killing an animal is unskillful. Unwholesome. That's the moral dimension. But we don't want to get into things like that are inanimate, no longer alive and everything. There's no moral dimension to. The Buddha says specifically, there meat, fish, and fowl, like the bird, is perfectly pure in three respects: not seen, heard, killed, on purpose for you, for just for you. This is to the monks. So this is our Vinaya rules for the monks. You can eat anything you want, monks. You're alms mendicants. You can't be telling people what they can and can't give you and so forth. It's not. You're going to go into a restaurant here. You're walking down the street in a village and people are kind enough to feed you. It's like you're not going to be... There's no... You're a mendicant. So he said, there's no moral dimension to this, but if somebody says, oh, I just killed this chicken just for you, say, well, please don't kill anything on my behalf. I have to refuse this, but if they said, you know, well, yeah, we had chicken last night and some left over, that's all right. See, they didn't kill it for you. It's just that what they're going to have anyway. Somebody invites you to dinner and so forth. It might be a vegetarian and they have a stew or something like that. But is it all right to eat it or is it immoral? Well, they would have bought it or done it anyway. So it's you're just accepting it with grace as an act of generosity. You're not encouraging them to eat meat. They don't need encouragement from you. They want to eat meat. They eat meat. You know, no matter what you say, they do that. What you are allowing them, and the Buddha says, you know, the monks, you're allowing the acts of generosity. Everybody, if you get all too legalistic with everybody right away, they might not understand it. They become offended. So monks, you receive these acts of generosity with grace and understand. Maybe as people move along, it has a civilizing effect in general with things, but you can't just be all uptight right at the beginning of things. What's that? First of all, I'll go with the preference. I mean, do I personally like meat? Are you asking me
if you're not receiving it from someone and you are going to make yourself a meal, which would you prefer?
Well, monks don't make food for themselves.
Oh, well.
monks are not allowed to buy food or keep food. All food expires at noon, and it has to be offered between dawn and noon by a layperson to me, and it has to be cooked. I can't cook it. And I have to finish it by noon, and it cannot be kept beyond that. So I'm in this position of being a recipient of generosity, and I'm not supposed to express my preferences about these things. So it's the last time you'll ever get what you want. I've had people try to, what do you like? You know, and, do you like this? Do you like that? Is that well, I could be. Oh, lots of food. They cook lots of food. Food, yeah. Huh? Yeah. I mean, we don't have a policy of vegetarian, strictly vegetarian. What I do tell the stewards, don't buy, if you're purchasing it with funds donated to the monastery, don't buy meat. But people come and offer meat or etc., and in that case, it's all right. The Buddha goes into this very closely. I had to deal with this issue very early on. Meat is, it's the fish or chicken or meat is okay, but not specifically, you know, you can't ask anybody to kill, you know, see that chicken there? Cut its head off, cook it, give it to me. Don't do that. That's an offense, yeah. There are certain types of meat that are not allowable, actually. It's very interesting. There's a certain list. One is human flesh. Not allowable. And then cat family and dog family. Not allowable. Yeah. Well, there's lots of places in the world where they eat cats and dogs, you know. But the Buddha said, no, don't do that. Oh, we're past our. Okay. Yes. Yes. So I think we'll wrap that up, and we're going to do the just a little ceremony at the end here, a traditional ceremony, and then I'm going to go upstairs. And if anybody wants to just come up and talk personally, I'll be up there for just about 45 minutes.
So just a little preamble, because we don't want to just sort of rush through this ceremony. We are wanting to do this ceremony for a particular reason in recognition of the ending. We have an ending happening with Ajahn Sona not wishing to travel anymore. So we have to go to him now rather than Ajahn coming to us. And it's been, everything is impermanent, so we'll we'll see. I was over next door on the Queenswood grounds, and just thinking that's the very first place we invited you to be,
yes.
And some of you might have been there. And so that was 7 years ago that Ajahn Sona came to Victoria. And for those of us who have known Ajahn Sona for longer than that, or since he's come to Victoria, I think we can all say that he has influenced us in personally in different ways and stimulated us to think about things or contemplate things, or, you know, you might like it or not like it, but it's always stimulating in terms of our Dhamma practice. And I also was thinking that as a group, this particular society, we've been very fortunate to have a monk come to our society, to Victoria. And Ajahn Sona was our first monastic visitor to this society. He was also our first male teacher. So many firsts. And since then, because we learned through Ajahn's compassion and teaching, we've learned how to receive and host monastics. And as those of you know, we've had nuns and monks come. And it's also because Ajahn Sona sort of, you know, said, yeah, you know, like it's a monk-friendly place. They're learning. They know, you know, you'll be treated. You won't be fed freshly killed chicken. So we have a lot of gratitude for Ajahn. And so this forgiveness ceremony is a way to, this is a beautiful part of the tradition. You might say, well, I didn't do anything. You know, it's just a lovely way to keep the harmony in the Sangha, Ajahn Sona's, the tradition within the monastic tradition. And as lay people, this is just a beautiful way for us to have this give and take acknowledgement. So there is one quote from the Buddha that the Dhamma is beautiful in the beginning, the middle, and the end. And that came to me today as I was thinking about Ajahn Sona's coming. It's just been beautiful in the beginning, middle, and now the end. And Brock wanted to share a story from the beginning before we get to the end.
I was doing some walking meditation over at Queenswood and just reflecting on the first time that Ajahn Sona came, which was in 2009. And I was just curious, who was at that retreat? So a number of people were at that retreat. And kind of a quick story. You've heard a little bit about the rules around food. And we were kind of nervous hosting Ajahn Sona and wondering if we were going to transgress some major rule and be blacklisted or, you know. And the situation, we had kind of set it up that there was a cafeteria. And on the first day, on Saturday, that Ajahn Sona and I would go to the cafeteria and I would offer him food. And we were going to try and hold the yogis back. But I think some of the parents brought maybe their adult sons. I don't know. There seemed to be about half a dozen teenage boys there who were just itching to get to the cafeteria. So as we're walking down the hall to the cafeteria, these boys were just running down the hall and beating us and lining up and chaos and taking food. And I was like mortified as we arrived behind the boys and kind of agitated and just on the verge, I was just about to sort of kind of like, get out of the way. The monk has to get their food for, you know. And I think Ajahn Sona sensed what was about to transpire. And he said, he didn't say anything. Nothing transpired verbally. But he just, with his hand, said like this. And it was, for me, a beautiful teaching of, this is the appropriate response in this situation. We'll let the boys go, and we'll take our food, and simple. So that was a memory I had, and I guess we didn't get blacklisted, and the monks came back.
Okay, so this ceremony, you have a sheet of paper, and you can come, you can participate in it or not. It's totally voluntary. So Brock's going to bow three times, and then he's going to offer the tray to Ajahn. And then you just follow along with what Brock's going to say from the sheet of paper.
Sir, for whatever wrongdoing we may have done towards towards you, my body, speech, or mind, with or without intention, please forgive us.
I forgive you, and may you also forgive me.